Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the king of satire, Armando Iannucci, talks to me about bringing Doctor Strangelove to the stage with Steve Coogan. Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story. I talked to the director of a fascinating new documentary about the brilliant Irish writer Edna O'Brien. Plus, we review Saturday Night, all about the birth of Saturday Night Live, as well as the strange new movie Companion. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. So I've mentioned to you once or twice before that in terms of me going to the cinema, I'm regularly in the cinema as just a regular cinema goer, or I'm often at a press screening early in the morning, or occasionally a premiere, don't you know? So I don't actually go to the cinema, you know, rocking in just off the street. However, I do from time to time. And last Sunday was a horrible weather day where we were, and two of my children were at a loose end, my 12-year-old boy and my 6-year-old son. And we went to a cinema and it was lashing rain. And the rain is important, as you'll come to understand. And we went to see Sonic the Hedgehog 3, which was actually very entertaining. And the 12-year-old and the 6-year-old really enjoyed it. And Jim Carrey was brilliant in it. So that was fine. Now, two very important things I want to tell you that I noticed that you might like me to share with you, and I'd love to know your thoughts on it. People regularly bemoan people using their phones in the cinema, but I noticed it was particularly bad at this screening because this was in essence a children's movie. And what had happened was, as far as I could tell, a lot of parents had decided they were going to bring their kids to the cinema and they were going to sit there and scroll through their phones, which I saw about 3 people do for the entire film. Like for nearly 2 hours, they just sat on their phones. Now, I know you might counter and say, well, it's a kid's movie. Maybe this is the only time these hardworking parents are getting where their children are quiet and not looking for stuff. But I still don't get it. Like, I've sat through Peppa Pig movies, seriously, without checking my phone. If you're in the cinema and it's dark and the movie is on, whatever the movie is, I'm sorry, your eyes should be on the screen. End of sermon. But here's the really strange thing about my trip to the cinema last Sunday. My 6-year-old said, as we sat down, I feel water. And I was like, no, you don't. Because, you know, kids say this stuff and you don't believe them. But then it kept going on and I started to feel water. And I looked up and there was a hole in the roof, or there was water getting down and landing on the seat in front of us, which was splashing in our faces. Now, I know there'd just been a storm and everything, but it was kind of odd that the seats weren't blocked off or anything like that. So we moved seats and, you know, all was fine then. And I went out to, because I had to get more drinks for the troops about halfway through the movie. And I said it to him and the guy was kind of like, ah, yeah, flat roofs, you'll get that. What seats were they? Clearly unfazed. And I wasn't the first punter to mention this to him. So, look, I know it was, you know, post bad storm and all, but I mean, if your business is putting people in seats, I think a prerequisite is those seats not have water on them or water actively falling on the patrons who are sitting in those seats. So cinema operators of the world, take note. Fix your roofs, please, because it's very important one doesn't get wet when you're watching a movie. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
So I'll never leave here.
You'll leave at 5. Well, actually, they stagger our exit, so 5:15. But it won't feel like it, not to this version of you, anyway.
Do I have a family?
You'll never know.
And I have no choice.
Well, every time you find yourself here, it's because you chose to come back.
Now, that's a clip from the much-talked-about series on Apple TV that has just started its second season, Severance. And we did this on Pat Kenny during the week. And by golly, it's a fascinating show, I have to say. Season one was out 3 years ago. So there has, in TV terms, been a long gap. Ben Stiller directs a lot of these episodes. And it's a fascinating show in that it's very strange. Good strange, though. We have Mark, played by Adam Scott, who is involved in this very strange dichotomy where he has signed up to be an employee in a company called Lumen. And what it is you go to your office every day and you are severed in that you have no memory of your outside life and you only have a memory of work when you're there. So when you leave work, you have no memory of work when you get home. When you're in work, you have no memory of your home life. So you are a completely split self. Sounds freaky? It is, but it's wildly entertaining. In that clip there, you heard the actress Britt Lower, who plays Helly, who's in this company Lumen, and she doesn't want to be there. Adam Scott's character does want to be there because his wife died in an accident, and this isn't a spoiler, and in a bid to get away from his pain, he signs up for this process of severance. Are you still with me? I know it sounds very trippy, and it is. And in this company where he's severed, he meets other seemingly like-minded individuals who want to escape life for various reasons. In tandem with that, we also have Mark encountering someone who's left Lumen in his outie life, his life when he's not in Lumen. And this adds this other narrative thread to it. I've watched the first season. I've watched episode one of season two. It is a real trip. It's a very strange philosophical show all about what's involved in having memories, what's involved in an actual work-life balance, who we are if we don't have memories. It's probably saying a lot about corporate America and corporate world in general. We have no idea who this company are. It's a real head trip. It is a brilliant cast. Outside of Adam Scott and Britt Lower, we have the great Christopher Walken playing an employee, as well as John Turturro. A really strange trip of a show. Now, it is philosophical, it is existential, but it has a great story going on as well that really keeps you guessing. So it's a big thumbs up from Severance. I don't want to say too much about it because if you haven't watched any of it, there are spoilers to be had there as you watch it. But it is on Apple TV and it is well worth a watch. So a big thumbs up from me for Severance. Now we turn to the cinema and I suppose to the theatre. Because Armando Iannucci, who is, I suppose, the daddy, the king, the godfather of satire behind such great shows as The Thick of It, Veep, movies like The Death of Stalin, In the Loop, a really funny, smart, genius guy who, you know, co-created Steve Coogan's Alan Partridge. And it's to a Steve Coogan collaboration again we turn because Dr. Strangelove is coming to the stage. It's already been in the West End and it's now going to be in the Bord Goss Energy Theatre from Wednesday the 5th of February to Saturday the 22nd for a limited run. This is Steve Coogan playing many roles from the Dr. Strangelove movie on the stage, a stage adaptation of it, which sounds absolutely fascinating, I have to say. The co-creator of it is the great Armando Iannucci. And I went to the Bord Goss Energy Theatre to talk to him yesterday all about the adaptation of Dr. Strangelove and obviously a bit more besides. Armando, lovely to see you. I'll start with a little name drop. I interviewed Willem Dafoe last year for Beetlejuice and I was saying to him, you know, it makes sense you doing Tim Burton. I'm surprised you haven't done it now. And you know, this is a political comedic satire with a brilliant central performance with a guy who plays lots of different people. And this screams Iannucci, if I can use you as a noun. Had you long wanted to do something like this with Strangelove?
It's always been one of my favourite films. The first time I saw it, I was like kind of bowled over by its the fact you could look at nuclear policy, foreign relations, the end of the world, and make it really funny. Mm. And then do this weird, you know, have Peter Sellers playing three different roles. And yet make it work.
Yeah.
That was interesting. But I had never in a million years thought I'd be adapting it for the stage.
That had never thought, you never thought this would be a good
Well, no,
stage
and actually, now. You know, when we were asked to do it, I said yes pretty instantly because for all those reasons. But I only discovered afterwards that it was the first time that the Kubrick family in the Kubrick estate had agreed to any of his films being adapted for another medium. And I'm glad I only knew that after I'd said yes. Because if they'd said that beforehand and they said, do you want to do it? I might have been slightly nervous. But I thought there's two things. One is it feels natural for the stage because the story is set in three very specific locations and it just dots between those three. So already you know that on stage you're not trying to create 150 different scenes. You know, you've got those three. You have also the plot, which is a bit like it's a very slow farce.
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got in the film Peter Sellers playing three different parts, which is crazy, but somehow links it all together.
Yeah.
And of course, Sellers has the advantage of being able to, you know, take hair and makeup and costume off and change into the next one and spend a week doing the next character and then another week doing the third character. Whereas someone like Steve, who's actually now doing four parts in the play, has to do all that live. So there's that added sense of theatricality. You know, it's a bit of a high wire act, actually, because he doesn't have very much time in between that part and then that part to get off, get changed, come on and, you know, leave there and come on here as someone completely different.
Yeah.
And I want the audience to wonder how it's done, really.
Yeah. We haven't seen it yet because it's not open yet. So we don't have to lie about having seen it. I loved your latest play.
Oh, you could have come over to London. I mean, you've been there for 4 months.
True.
I mean, come on.
No, yeah, no. That's true. That's true. Failing that, though, but I have to ask, my favorite one is The Bomb, Sergei, The Bomb. We talked about it. Is that
yes.
in
Yes. Yes.
Okay, great. Yes. I hear that someone on the way in, the lovely Jill from Borgosh, told me that it has the highest rate of sellouts in the Noel Coward
yes.
ever.
Yeah.
So why, like, what are, can you say what's working? Like, why is it so well received?
It's actually, people find it hysterical, but they also find it kind of strangely moving in a way.
Okay.
They find it, they like the theatricality of it. I mean, it's a very, it's an inventive set. We have a B-52 bomber on stage at one point. Things turn into other things. Steve Coogan is there, and then now he's here, but he's just been there. Mm. There's all that going on. There's an amazing ensemble company. And it's about big stuff in the end. You know, it's about absurdity and stupid silliness, and yet it's about fate and the future.
Yeah.
So it's all that in 2 hours. So, and people like, I think people want to see stuff in the flesh. Yeah. You know, we spend so much time behind our screens that actually to get out and actually see something that's completely different and completely feels like nothing you've seen before.
Yeah. Forgive me if you've been asked this all day, but it's such an obvious, important question. You know, I mentioned The Bomb, Sergei, The Bomb. Is The Bomb now AI or is it Trump? Like, is it because we live in such crazy times that you think this story is not prescient, but of the now? But I guess everyone's probably suggesting
that.
Well,
no, I mean, interesting. I mean, when we were asked to do it was about 3 years ago. Okay. So this was before Putin had invaded Ukraine. And it was that. It was, the film's about the end of the world. So what is the bomb? It's a metaphor for climate change, or it's a metaphor for, you know, technology or whatever. But actually, as we started performing it, we have an erratic Russian president with his hand on the nuclear button. We now have an erratic American president.
Yeah.
The general, the American general, who triggers the whole thing in the first place, is obsessed with the fluoridation of America's water.
Yeah.
We now have Robert Kennedy Jr. About to, you know, we have Dr. Strangelove, this scientist, not American, who had worked with the Germans in the 40s on various experiments, now working with NASA, or as he pronounces it, NASA, on rockets and technology. We have, as we do the show, an actual Elon Musk, rockets and technology, who's right there with the president. So it's less and less a metaphor, more and more a documentation of what's going on.
Yeah. But like, as someone who's very interested in the state of the world and always has been and what you're doing, like, is there a sense like this was, however, over 50 years ago now that it was written? Like, it's a very grandiose question, but isn't there always going to be some bomb, like in 100 years' time, if
it
we were sitting here?
Yeah, it is that sense. I think you're right. I think it kind of, the bomb is there as a way of focusing on that sense of impending doom, but we don't quite know what it is.
Yeah.
And it's never been more prevalent than now, I don't think. I think, I feel concerned for the younger generation who, you know, we've told the planet's in a mess and it looks like we're left a bit late.
Yeah.
Plus you have no money. and if you're British, we took you out of Europe.
Yeah.
They've elected. I won't even begin to explain America now. You know, you can either laugh or you can scream. Those are the alternatives, really.
Yeah. You're taking it to Ireland here, which is great. And unlike so many people who come here, as far as I know, you don't have any Irish in you, as it goes. But Annucci is obviously Italian. And you were second generation Italian in Scotland. And I wonder, when you look back on it now, like, we're so much more attuned to that experience now. But was that this is a strange way to describe your childhood, but a blessing or a curse, having that surname growing up?
It's a strange thing. And I think there's always a bit of both, in that I always felt inside and outside. You know, I felt Scottish and yet Italian. So if I was a very Scottish thing, like a Cayley, I think, this is a bit odd. And then if I went to like an Italian wedding or something like that, I'd think, this is a bit odd. Now, I don't know whether it's just me finding everything odd or whether it's part of that, what am I? And it's complicated by the fact that, you know, I'm in a country, Britain, which doesn't even know what it's called. Is it United Kingdom? Is it Britain? Great Britain? What is it? England? No, it's not England. I'm from Scotland. So, you know, I'm an Italian in Scotland, and then I moved to London, so I'm a Scot in England. And then I did Veep in America, so I was a Brit in America. So I've always been that kind of neither inside nor out. And I think there is a bit of both. There is always that, I wish it was just basically simple, you know. but also, it allows you to kind of be a bit more detached. Certainly when we were doing Veep in America, a lot of Americans were saying, because I was a bit worried that they would like not like the idea of people from outside coming in and laughing at their politics. But a lot of them said, no, it kind of needs someone from outside, because they grew up so much in a Democrat or Republican household or state or district that it's real. The divisions are really hardwired into them right from the start. So it's difficult to take a total view. So they said, no, it needs people from outside to kind of look at the whole thing.
Yeah. When from the thick of it to In the Loop, I know they're different things, but they're of a kind, let's say. Making a movie, was that a big leap for you?
It is actually, because you have like one go at it. Yeah. You know I mean, you don't do a pilot movie and a movie series one and see, you know, with a TV show with lots of episodes, obviously you want to get it right, but you're also discovering things as you're doing it. And you think, oh, that's a funny idea. Maybe later on there's an episode where this happens. You know, you're allowing them to grow, and you're allowing yourself to evolve with it, and the cast get to know the characters really well, and they start to kind of get a better understanding of the characters. So it's a growing thing. With a film, you know, it's all in the planning, because the moment you start, it's this just unstoppable juggernaut. There's time to play about in scenes and so on, but fundamentally, you've got to have the story right. You've got to have the script right. Obviously, the casting has got to be right. Because once you start, it's very difficult to pause and go, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
You know, and you allow yourself a little bit of safety at the end to go back and maybe reshoot a few things, having learnt. It's just that thing of, once the cast have been filming for like 30 or 40 days, they know so much more about each other that I often go back and shoot whatever it was I shot on day one. I go back at the end and shoot it again. It's just because everyone's more in the skin of the character.
Yeah. And then just finally, I was fascinated to hear you sitting your grade one exam in piano at the age of 40 and barely scraping through. But you stopped then, I gather, after grade one instead of keeping going.
Well, only because I was then was doing a film and it completely shot my practice to bits.
Okay.
And it was such a trauma doing grade one.
So you haven't gone back to it, have you?
I haven't. No, I should really. But I kind of enjoyed it. But yeah, I sat it in. I didn't realise you do it at someone's house. And I sat sitting next to lots of 5 and 6 year olds who were also sat in this back kitchen.
But you passed, right?
By one, yeah.
Okay, grade one by one.
I think 100 is the pass, so I got 101.
Okay.
But, you know, I was listening to this Chopin mazurka perfectly played and a seven-year-old coming out at the end of it and thinking, oh, God. And I was on a little plastic chair because they'd set out just chairs for 6 and 7 year olds.
Yeah. Well, look, piano tuition's loss is movies and TV's gain. Lovely to meet you.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
Thank you. Armando Iannucci there, talking to me about all sorts of things, but doing his grade one exams on piano in his 40s and barely passing, his Italian heritage, and of course, making satire, and of course, co-adapting Dr. Strangelove for the Borgos Energy Theatre, starring Steve Coogan, which is going to be on stage from Wednesday the 5th of February to Saturday the 22nd. This is the first place it's gone after the West End, and I for one can't wait to see it, and we'll be going along next week, all going to plan, and I'll let you know what it's like. What I'm going to let you know about after the break is the new movie releases, including Saturday Night, all about the launch of the famous Saturday Night Live. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn now to some of the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is a movie called Companion, which is about possibly a sex robot. We'll find out more. And also a great new movie, which I've seen, and there I'm spoiling it for you because I'm telling you it's great, called Saturday Night, all about the first broadcast of Saturday Night Live. Delighted to be joined now by freelance writer and film buff, Niamh O'Reilly, who has been to the cinema to see both. Hello, Niamh.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. So I haven't seen Companion, so let's start with that.
Yeah.
So I was a bit euphemistic there. Sex robot goes bad. But I'm not wildly off the mark.
No, you're not far off at all. We could just leave it there. Yes, sex robot goes
mad. Go
see it. It's great. So yeah, this stars Jack Quaid, who is the son of Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan. Looks scarily like both of them at times. Yeah. The genes are strong with him. And also Sophie Thatcher, who was in Heretic last year, a very good horror film. So they play a couple called Iris and Josh, who are very much in love. And they're going off for a lovely weekend at their friend's house, a very big secluded mansion in the middle of a forest in the middle of nowhere. And the film opens with a flashback to their meet cute. And it is the cutest of meet cutes. She is.
How so?
Well, she's pushing along a trolley looking very much like a Stepford wife in a supermarket, and he's by some oranges, which he knocks over and their eyes meet and it's fireworks. But from the off, something seems a little odd about this meet right. cute. And as you have alluded to, it is revealed very quickly that she is in fact a robot.
Yeah.
A companion robot of sorts, or a sex robot, if you want to call her that. Now, she's not aware that she is a robot. So she just believes she's in a normal relationship with her boyfriend, and they're going away for the weekend with two other couples. But all is not obviously what it seems, and things go south quite quickly. I'm not going to get into more details about the plot because it would spoil it.
Okay.
And I know in the trailer it has been revealed that she is a robot.
Yeah.
And people have said, oh, that's a spoiler. That isn't the spoiler.
Right.
There's plenty of other twists and turns coming, which is great.
And you're stopping there.
I am.
Our audience will appreciate
they
that.
Will.
So the thing is, that sounds very interesting and an interesting idea and very of the now, right? But, you know, sometimes a great idea, people forget you have to make a 2-hour movie out of this. Does it work? Does it go somewhere?
It works really well. This is from the team that brought us a great film called Barbarian from a couple of years ago, which was a very twisty, turny, darkly comic horror,
I suppose. Yeah, with Nicolas Cage.
No, not Nicolas Cage. It was with Justin Long.
Oh yeah, I think we reviewed that.
It's very
My memory
good.
Isn't what it was.
I'm not even sure it got a cinema release. It might have, but anyway, it's on a streamer now if people want to look at it. But that kind of very very cleverly mixed genres, and this film does the same. So it's a dark comedy, really, with a little bit of horror. I don't really want to say horror, thriller thrown in, a bit of gore and a bit of sci-fi. And the thing about it is you don't really know where it's going to go. And the twists when they're revealed are slightly obvious, but they're still quite enjoyable. And there's a good payoff there.
Okay.
And while you're saying, you know, a film about a robot is quite timely, it is. It doesn't have too many lofty ideals.
Okay.
It's not something like Ex Machina, which is like the musings of whether this is the right thing to do and all of that. It's more, if you were going to get really critical about it, it's more looking at human nature and how we can take something intended for good and do quite bad things to it or with it. But it's not heavy in that way.
So it's not a profound meditation on AI.
It's not.
Okay.
It's funny.
Is it a send-up of rom-coms to an extent?
It is a little bit, and I think the timing of this is great. It would be a really kick-ass first date or date movie if you wanted to bring your significant other to it, because it's a whole lot of fun and does look at kind of relationships and who's the controlling one and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I have to say the performances in this are great. Jack Quaid, who people will be familiar with from The Boys and Scream, he has that when you look at him, like he's got this charming face, very handsome, but he's kind of got that wicked little bit of something about him, and he's really leaned into this kind of darkly comic, almost horror niche that he's found himself in, and it works really well here. And Sophie Thatcher as Iris, she's just got this quality about her. She's got these big eyes, very innocent looking, but there's a little more going on, you know, under the surface. So the two of them have a great chemistry here, and they look like they're having a total blast. And also Rupert Friend has an extended cameo as a Russian guy called Sergei. He has this dodgy...
What else would he be called?
I know. He's like a dodgy mullet, a Donald Trump-style tan and a very bad Russian accent. And he's really good in this. He steals every scene that he's in.
Okay. And just on Sophie Thatcher, you know, she's playing a robot in essence, but she pulls that off.
She pulls that off so well. And I mean, as I said, she doesn't know that she's a robot. So at some point she does find that out. And that's when the switcheroo comes and you can really see her develop that out.
Yeah.
But she's having a lot of fun with it. This isn't too serious. This is what I would call, you know, a mid-level kick-ass popcorn film. The type of movies we don't see that much of getting released in the cinema anymore. They tend to go straight to streamers.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's very enjoyable.
So what would you say stars-wise for Companion, which is in cinemas from the 31st of January?
Very hearty 3. Really enjoyable.
A hearty 3. Okay, these quantifying adjectives she keeps at are qualifying adjectives. Strong, hearty.
Yeah.
You know, she can't just give a simple score. Well, we better take a quick clip of the hearty Companion.
My friends don't hate you.
Cat does.
Yeah, maybe, but Cat hates everybody.
I just don't want to screw everything up.
Come on, Beep Boop, you're not going to screw everything up. Just relax, you know? Don't be all moopy and weird. Just remember to smile and act happy, okay?
That is a clip from Companion, which Niamh O'Reilly is giving 3 stars to, but a hearty 3 stars. So bear that in mind, listeners. Now, another new cinema release this week, which I have seen, is Saturday Night, which tells the chaotic, I guess it's fair to say, hour and a half or thereabouts, right before the first Saturday Night Live goes on air. And we have all sorts of people being played. So we have like an actor playing Chevy Chase and things like that as well. And indeed, the great John Belushi. Over to you, Niamh.
Yeah, I was really surprised by this. But I have to say, going in, I like these sort of films that pull back the curtain on what goes on backstage, so in the making of a TV show or a movie or a play, because what happens backstage is often 10 times more interesting.
Much
like radio. If you only knew what was happening behind the scenes, we won't tell you. It's very much in that vein. And you're right, it's the hour and a half leading up to the very first episode of Saturday Night Live, which made it to air on a wing and a prayer. Mm. And the show obviously has cult status in America. It's
50
huge.
Years this year.
50 years.
And I'm not sure your take on it, but like some of the people who've come out of that are comedic gods to me, you know, Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, Eddie Murphy, all these people. Yet when you watch Saturday Night Live, it's often very hit and miss.
You've hit the nail on the head. So the show, it's a cultural phenomenon in America, but it hasn't translated outside of America in the same way, because you're right, a lot of the time it's not funny.
It's downright odd.
It's weird. Yeah. It's not funny. And I think even for the American sense of humour, it's not funny. And I think as it's gone on in years, it's become less funny.
But it is live.
It is live. So anything can happen. And that was the appeal of it. And I think when it first started, it was kind of this counterculture movement by a bunch of unknown, unproven, untested 20-somethings who were brilliant, but nobody knew if they could pull this off. And they were totally anti-establishment. John Belushi was getting high, you know, backstage, fighting with Chevy Chase.
Refusing to wear a bee costume.
Which I don't blame him. But so it was chaos backstage. And how it made it to air, I mean, it is a fascinating story. And the main protagonist in this is Lorne Michaels, who's still involved with the show to this day. Yeah. It was his brainchild, his idea. And the pressure that gets loaded on this man throughout the hour and a half, it's quite something, you know, at times. And you feel for him. Yeah, everyone who's anyone came out of this show. And the performances, I thought, were great. We've got Chevy Chase, as you said. We've got Dan Aykroyd.
But these are all played by different actors.
Yes, all played by different actors. Sort of unknowns, really. None of them would be particularly famous. But they have done a great job. You wouldn't have to look at the actor playing Chevy Chase to know, okay, well, that's Chevy Chase. The hair, the styling, the voice, the mannerisms is perfect. And I think people might criticise that and say, well, it's just mimicry. But I think in a film like this, there is so much going on. They're trying to pack so much into the hour and a half. You're never going to get a deep dive into why John Belushi was such a tortured, you know, genius, why, you know, Gilda Radner was such a trailblazer. You don't get any of that. There's one small scene between the two of those. They escape the studio for a little while and they go out to Rockefeller Center and they're skating. And Gilda Radner kind of has this moment and she's like, do you ever, you know, wonder in a few years, we look back at this moment, we'll be here with our kids. And that was quite poignant because both of them died far too young. Yeah. And both were absolute, you know, they were so, so comedy legends.
Yeah. And she ended up marrying
Gene Wilder. And she died of ovarian cancer.
Very sad. And there are other moments like that where, like, one of the TV executives says to Chevy Chase, you could have your own show in years to come, which he famously did, and it was a disaster.
Yeah, there
were some very knowing glances.
Foreshadowing.
That's a much better way of putting it. The actor who plays Lauren Michaels,
Gabriel LaBelle, he was in Meet the Fablemans.
Yeah.
Or Meet the Fablemans?
Yeah. The Fablemans.
I always call it Meet the Fablemans, and it's not.
I interviewed him. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And he is brilliant as Lauren Michaels, I thought. And just that kind of, am I about to die here?
Yeah.
He carried that off brilliantly.
You can see it all in his face.
He carries it.
Yeah, he's really good. And there's some nice little cameos here from J.K. Simmons.
Brilliant.
And Willem Dafoe.
J.K. Simmons, as you say, plays
Milton Berle.
Brilliant.
And Willem Dafoe is an executive called Dave Tebbutt, who
brilliant
doesn't
well
really want the show. No. I mean, the NBC, who were like the BBC of America, they were in dispute with Johnny Carson, who was the huge star, and they were showing reruns on a Saturday night. So this show was kind of pitched or given to Lorne Michaels as, you know, pitch me something, but they didn't actually want it to come to air. It was just to prove a point to Johnny Carson. So it was amazing it made it.
And famously, they had a rerun on tape ready to
ready
play.
To press
if
the button.
The wheel should come off.
Even though you know how this is going to play out, you're kind of, is it going to go on air? Is it not? You
it's anxiety inducing watching it.
It is, but it's enjoyable. I really enjoyed it, this, I thought. It was very, very good.
I completely agree with you. What would you say stars-wise for Saturday night?
I would say, again, a hearty three.
A hearty three. I thought you were going to go to a fulsome four. I actually think I would give it four.
Would you?
I was really, really entertained by this for the most part, I have to say. So that is three. Another hearty three. It's a full four for me. I may have just been basking in seeing all these young talents.
Lovely. And I think maybe you and I were similar vintage. So it's lovely. Like, the guy playing John Belushi does such a terrific job. At times, you could think,
that's
we're looking
Belushi
at them. So it was, from a nostalgia point of view, it was lovely. Yeah. And it does sweep you away a little bit. Yeah.
So that is Saturday Night, which is also in cinemas from the 31st of January. It's a thumbs up for both movies this week from Niamh O'Reilly. Niamh, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Jesus, you guys look like the cast of Godfather if it was shot in Alabama. I see some cowboys here.
That's a hell of a 10-gallon hat. You look like you're ready for a date with livestock.
Sir, you look like you're from Ohio. My favorite thing about Ohio. Let me introduce you to our head writer, our Prince of Darkness, Michael O'Donoghue.
Thank you. Thank you, Chevy.
A clip there from Saturday Night, which I really enjoyed, I have to say, all about Saturday Night Live. A very strange TV show in that I don't find it that funny a lot of the time, but it's unique and its cultural importance is huge. And I thought the movie about its first episode was fascinating. So well worth a trip to the cinema for Saturday Night. And Niamh gave Companion also a hearty 3, as you heard there. Up next, Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story.
CarMax knows that finding the right car is all about exploring your options, like the option to shop your way on your schedule. At CarMax, you can browse, compare, and pre-qualify online, then finish up at the store, or simply start on the lot. The choice is yours. Because at CarMax, you're in the driver's seat. Start the search for your next car today at CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now releasing in cinemas this weekend is Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story. And we have, I suppose, the story beginning in her childhood home. We move all the way to 1960s London and, of course, her debut novel, The Country Girls, which became a literary sensation, as did she, writing for The New Yorker, delivering provocative interviews and authoring screenplays. Her success enraged her writer husband and kind of made her a pariah in her native Ireland, where her books, as you may know, were banned and, as this great movie shows, were actually burned. She would, as I say, spend a lot of time in London, had many well-known and not so well-known affairs and star-studded parties. In The Blue Road, which was directed by Sinead O'Shea, huge access was granted to her in the form of her personal journeys, which are read aloud by the great Jessie Buckley. And we have additional perspectives from Gabriel Byrne, Walter Mosley, and all sorts of other people. It's a fascinating watch, and I'm delighted to say Sinead joins me now. Hi, Sinead, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Can I just ask, I was reading something in the notes and it said that you met Edna 10 years ago and you spent an afternoon with her and you laughed, but you also wept, it says, but you can tell me. And I'm wondering what made the two of you cry.
Oh my God, I can't believe I wrote that down. I think I was basically nursing a broken heart, and I had to go and interview Edna. And actually, it's funny, I was very underwhelmed at the prospect of interviewing her because I hadn't read her books, but then I read her books and realized how good they were. And then I met her, and she's just a very charismatic person. And I suppose her writing, it's all about fanatic hearts, as she puts it, and bad men, and like doomed romances. So I guess within minutes I was telling her my latest apocalypse. And I don't know, it ended up becoming quite intimate very quickly. But the funny thing is, she has absolutely no memory of that. For her, that would be a standard encounter with any person. She just was somebody who was like that, you know, just very open and very curious, I suppose, and very intense.
That's fascinating. Tell me this. A couple of things really struck me about the documentary. So a lot of people of my generation would be aware that Country Girls was banned in Ireland. I mean, I didn't know about the burning, which we see in the movie. But my sense of it traditionally had been, you know, Ireland abandoned her and they didn't know the genius that was in their midst. But I mean, she came up against a lot of, you know, downright misogyny in England and to a lesser extent in America. Like, there's one scene where, you know, Melvyn Bragg, who I have a lot of time for, having watched the South Bank show for many years, you know, she says something about men are only useful for, you know, occasional romance and foreplay or something like that. And he seems quite dismissive and alarmed by it. I mean, she encountered misogyny everywhere, not just in Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, I think in his defense, he may have been more alarmed and astounded than dismissive. I think he was absolutely shocked to his core. Like, he was not expecting that answer out of her. But I agree with you. Generally, she was treated in a way that was completely different to her male peers. Like, so male writers of that time, you know, there was a really strong tradition of them being, you know, boozy bousies, I suppose, you know, just raconteurs who were always in the pub. You know, you have Norman Mailer stabbing one of his wives. They're all boasting about how many women they've bedded. Whereas Edna, who actually, you know, was far less promiscuous in those days, was being treated as some kind of scarlet woman all the time. And I think there was a real imbalance. She chose to write about women's matters, women's ideas. And so often that was dismissed as kind of softer, frothier fare. And then just if you see, as you say, the way interviewers actually approach her, you know, there's always a kind of patronizing, kind of laughing manner about how they do it. You know, I think in Ireland, because there was such an issue here with, I guess, how church and state were working together to make it such a difficult place for women, I think here she really embodied, you know, the sinner. Whereas in England, I think the treatment was more to do with her being Irish. So I found lots of interviewers, you know, where the interviewer is saying, you know, look at this place, it's so desolate, you know,
yeah,
like Ireland. Because it was desolate because you came here and colonized the whole place. That's why. And she's always quite polite. It's funny, everyone keeps saying, wow, she's so feisty in these interviews. I think, if anything, she's quite restrained.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in terms of the interviews, you, and I probably should have asked you this at the beginning, but after your meeting 10 years ago and the weeping and the fun and all that, did it take much convincing for her to sit for you and go through her life with you?
Yeah, it did actually take a while. Well, I mean, I just filed that first encounter away as, you know, kind of wonderful, unique experience. Mm. But then I was at a wedding 2 years ago and I quoted her to a wedding guest who said, oh, she's one of my best friends and you should make a documentary about her. And I just thought, yeah, that's a great idea. So they spent about a year chasing Edna, kind of most of 2023. And she wasn't interested. And then that wedding guest turned out to be the producer of the James Bond films, Barbara Broccoli. And so she really was best friends with her. And so she went round to her house and I think kind of frog marched Edna into the interview. So we did that interview in August 2023. So it took no convincing by Barbara, but it took many unanswered emails from me as well.
Okay, well, you got there. So, you know, just to not to do amateur Freudianism on it, but I think anyone will be struck by this. You know, her father was a difficult man, it had to be said. Now, not that she hated him or anything like that. And she then marries Gebler. His first name momentarily escapes me. You'll remind me his first name was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cartoon villain.
Yeah. And you know, I'm groping around for words to describe him. But to be honest, the one that keeps popping into my head is prick. He was awful to her.
He didn't have the vocabulary for it then. But I think he was an abuser in retrospect.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was pretty awful to his children as well. So there seems to be, you made a discovery, but you clarify for this, because as I mentioned, we have her journals and read brilliantly by Jesse Buckley. And then we see that he writes over them or almost concludes the thoughts of her and dismisses things she's saying. Was that your discovery?
Yes. It's interesting because she directed me to those diaries specifically. And I think she really wanted me to discover that so that it could be included in the film. But she didn't tell me that that was going to be in the diaries. She just said, I want you to go to Emory College in Georgia, which is where they were kept. So that's, I guess you could say it was my discovery, quote unquote, but the diaries were there. And so then I had to verify them, as you see in the film, with her son, Carlo, which was, felt a bit awkward because some of the things that her husband had written are so shocking. Like, they're incredible. Like, his hatred for his in-laws is sort of almost comic. It's fairly, fairly baroque, slit-eyed peasants. All this is So I was a bit worried, you know, about breaking Carlo's heart because, you know, Carlo has a lot of esteem for his grandparents. But funnily, Carlo was really robust about it because the dad I didn't realize this, he was a notorious annotator. So he used to write all over photo albums. He would take Edna's books out of the local library and write all over those and put them back into the local library. So this was his thing. He basically, when she finally left him, he made it his life's work to destroy her reputation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, in the parlance of today, he would rightly be described as an abuser. She deserves a huge amount of credit for getting out from under him. It wasn't an easy thing to do in the 60s and moving out. You know, you mentioned her son, Carlo Gebler, who's a writer, a very successful one in his own right. And you mentioned his robustness in one of the interviews with him. I had actually been meaning to ask you that. I felt at times he was uncomfortable maybe sitting there talking about this stuff. But again, you tell me, was that just my take on it,
I think he's amazing in it. I think
he's really watchable.
I'm really touching. I think he wanted to really express it properly because he is a writer and so he is very careful about words. And I think the part which moves me the most is when he's describing the atmosphere in his house as he was growing up. You know, it's so oppressive. It's so awful. You know, the father is just this terrible presence all the time. And when the mother leaves, it's really hard for them. And as you say, it was incredible that she managed to get away from him, but she paid a high price, as did they. So I suppose when I say he's robust, I just mean he's amazing to have survived this. And it's amazing that he has made a good life for himself. He has a lovely family in Enniskillen and he has a good writing career and he teaches in Trinity. I just think he's brilliant because a lot of people would have gone under. It's brutal how the father treats them. You know that bit as well in the film where he said there'll be no more Christmas presents. He's their ex-father.
Yeah.
Signs a letter. Like it's
really it's heartbreaking for any son or father, any human being. I was really struck by that. There is brilliant archive footage in it of Edna in all sorts of places. But the one in particular that got me, and I'm sure lots of people are saying this to you about it, is where she's at home back with her mother and father and her dad is singing, if I'm not mistaken, and it's clearly for some TV show in the 70s or something like that where they're doing a profile of her. But she looks uncomfortable as she's sitting there watching her father. That, and then you show her that footage and it's clearly a moment. Can you just tell us how that bit came about?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that archive landed for you as well, because as soon as I saw it when I found it, during that kind of year of fruitlessly emailing her various agents, I said to myself, oh my God, that's so significant. Because as you say, she's in her 40s. She is safe, but she looks so uncomfortable. So when I found that footage, I downloaded it on my laptop. And when I did that first interview with her in August, she, after 40 minutes, wanted to stop it because she was feeling too weak. So I just said, oh, Edna, can you sit here and I'll show you this footage? And it was really interesting. I think that footage really revived her in a way and kind of reconnected her with her past. And I suppose it made her want to do the film. So she decided to keep taking part and she would send voice memos then from the hospital. She was admitted to hospital the next day. And then I did more audio interviews with her. And then I meet her again for that final camera interview. But
yeah.
It all kind of came back to that piece of archive because it is telling a story. And, you know, again, it's a British interviewer who doesn't understand, I guess, the ability Irish families have to lie. So, you know, the mother.
That's a uniquely Irish quality.
Well, maybe not uniquely Irish, but he just wouldn't be attuned, I suppose, to the tells. I think an Irish person looks at that footage and straight away knows what's going on, that they're putting on a front for an English person, whereas an English person is like, wow, these people are really nice.
Yeah.
Like, look at this man just singing Danny Boy. And the mother is saying, oh, her books never bothered me. And Edna, she looks kind of polite, but she's not, you know, she's really terrified. And I just thought it was a really revealing piece.
I feel like I'm going down a slightly dark rabbit hole with all those questions. She lived such a fascinating life, but she was also wildly successful and rightly now being lauded as a true pioneer in the Irish and you know, international literary scene, and rightly so. You know, up in the 90s, she had kind of a resurgence. And I remember a whole furore around In the Forest when that book came out. And I remember an interview listening to her on Rattlebag, and you have some footage of that as well. Do you think, you know, and your film is certainly going to help to this, do you think we have now given her her rightful place in the literary and Irish canon?
I think so to an extent. I mean, Country Girls was chosen as, you know, by the Dublin City Council, for example, as I think their book of the year thing. So that's, you know, quite a big honour. I think everyone would recognise at this stage that Country Girls is a classic and it's one of the great books of Irish literature. I think something like A Pagan Place is a very overlooked masterpiece, and maybe more people will come to recognise how good it is. I think Little Red Chairs, when it came out in 2015, was very well received. That is a very good book, a very good kind of synthesis of politics and women's affairs. It's kind of a mixture. I think certainly there's people my age and younger who just didn't know anything about her, I think. Yeah. So maybe that's what this film might do. I'd say she's always had her devotees, but she definitely wouldn't have had the respect of a lot of that her male peers was getting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, hopefully your film will add to that list of devotees. And in a way, we've only scratched the surface. We didn't even get into her being at home with Marlon Brando and him asking for cake instead of champagne.
But those
wonderful moments are all contained in Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story, which is in cinemas. You should go and see it. It was written and directed by Sinead O'Shea, who previously gave us a fantastic documentary I didn't even mention, Pray for Our Sinners. Sinead, thanks a million.
Thanks so much.
Whatever wise man said, there's no sense being Irish if you don't know the world will break your heart, might have been thinking of the author and bon vivant Edna O'Brien.
Unquestionably, one of the best thought of writers in the English language today.
It didn't come easy.
You probably have a unique distinction in that all your books are Irish.
I'm not always sensitive about it because all the censors and bishops and judges, they're all men.
The good times are middling. The bad times are bad.
But not her fault. Nothing to do with her adolescent vanity.
She became quite a famous party giver, if you like, in London. Everybody who was anybody went to Edna's parties.
I knew it was transitory. We were all en route, heading for other places, orbiting up, up.
A clip there from Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story. And you heard me talking to its director, Sinead O'Shea. And a great watch that is as well. Good week for the cinema, Irish and international. That is it for this week. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.